Hello and welcome to episode 9 of season 2 of AS for Architecture with me, Ambrose Gillick. I'm talking today to Paul Dobraschik, an architectural writer, teacher and photographer, about his 2021 book, Architecture and Anarchism, Building Without Authority, published by Paul Homberton.
It's more what would be called now prefigurative or emergent politics, which is really about describing things that people do and then saying, you know, they exhibit kind of anarchist tendencies, but in a way that people don't quite know that they're doing that. This is a sort of unconscious idea of how politics might work. And Ward would point to people like allotment owners, people who are squatting through necessity, or even things like children's playgrounds, where he would see certain kind of tendencies within things that he observed there as being indicative of kind of something else or something else that could be nurtured and grow, which how he sees a kind of notion of how change, radical change, could happen.
A is for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome again to A is for Architecture. I'm talking today to Paul Dobraschik. Paul, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Hi, thanks, Ambrose. Yeah, so I'm I describe myself as an architectural writer. I teach part-time at the Bartlett School of Architecture, and so far I've written 10 books. The 10th book is out next spring, and I cover a variety of subjects. I mean, I would say architecture and cities are my main interests. But within that really broad overarching kind of desire to really expand and broaden the notion of what architecture is, particularly how it relates to culture in the broad. So I call that kind of the imagination really as my kind of shorthand. And it's, you know, I find that, you know, I look at the world through buildings. And that's how I kind of generate the material. Basically, it's a never ending process, right? You know, once you because nothing can be exhausted, and I find that very, very compelling. And architecture is just the vehicle, if you like, that I've chosen.
So, are you trained as an architect?
No, I did originally I did a year of architecture school at the Architectural Association in London back in 1993, and had a minor nervous breakdown, which is absolutely normal for architecture students to have minor, sometimes major nervous breakdowns at the end of beginning my second year. And I left the school. And it took me the rest of that year to really sort of recover myself. And then I went to study art history and had a much better time studying art history.
Where did you study that?
I studied that at the University of Reading. And then I stayed at the University of Reading to do a master's and a PhD before moving to Manchester in 2011.
I see. What was your... I should have introduced you as Dr. Paul, but I'm sorry for that misnomer. What was your doctorate? What was your doctoral thesis on? Do you even remember? Can you ever forget?
It was an unusual subject, really, for an art history PhD, that it was on images of the construction and reception of London's sanitation system. So it was about underground spaces, but also quite interesting works of architecture, which are the pumping stations associated with the sanitation system. But it was really a project about the cultural side, what I would call the cultural side of something which doesn't at first look like it would have much of a culture, you know, the culture of sewers, if you like. Yeah. And part of that was buildings, but part of it was images in newspapers. And it was very much the middle part of the 19th century when this part of this kind of aspect of London's infrastructure was transformed.
So and how was that pictured in I mean, these days you do hear quite a lot about London sewers, but mainly through things like Fatbergs. And John Outram's pumping station. I think they're the only two kind of engagements I ever have with it now.
Well, actually, it's interesting because at the moment, Thames Water are building the Tideway Tunnel, which is the most significant intervention since the 1860s when the Victorian system was built. And there is a certain amount of visibility there, but it hasn't quite captured the public imagination, even though it's billions of pounds that's being spent. It's different now. I think when these things were first built, there was more of a public interest, I think, and a sort of sense of excitement about the change, and also a lot more disruption. So the way they were built was not deep level tunneling primarily. There was a lot of kind of digging up of roads and parks in order to install these things underground. So there was a kind of sense in which they were much more obvious in the city when they were first built. And the attention, the architectural attention given to the pumping stations. I know John Outram's building is an interesting kind of more modern example of a playful approach, a decorative approach. But that's not generally the case with utility. I mean, structures associated with infrastructure. But in the Victorian period, there was just, you know, a lavish amount of attention given to these buildings. So the pumping station at Abbey Mills and Cross Ness are quite kind of extraordinary works of architecture in their own right. Very eclectic, lots of colour in the sort of building materials, very sort of almost orientalist kind of styles of architecture. And I think one of the big question I had was why? You know, why did the Victorians do this? And in a way, I never quite answered that question, because it's kind of like trying to get into the mind of an alien when you're trying to think about the reasons why people do things in the past. But I think it was to do with a different sort of mindset about the relationship between architecture and other things, right? You know, we have a much more compartmentalized view, I think, today of what architecture should be and how it should look and how it should work, which I think is quite impoverished, actually. We tend to be quite reductive about what we expect of buildings. Whereas the Victorians are much more complicated and strange and somehow, and also often conflicted. And they thought buildings spoke to them, right? They had this idea that, you know, you can read a building in its ornament and its decoration, which we really don't have at all now. So it's a fascinating kind of thing to go back to a different mindset and try and think through their own kind of expectations.
Yeah, for sure. The idea of figurative architecture is, I think, probably something like figurative architecture, somehow making a comeback with the rise of decoration again. Forms of decoration, either through color, but even in buildings as decorations, like obviously our jazzy kind of Guggenheim effect style buildings. But there is that certainly is coming back, but with a much, much smaller budget. So it tends not to be quite so ornate and over the top. But we shouldn't, without further ado, we should talk about the book. So you've got this beautiful book, Architecture and Anarchism. And I saw this through, I can't remember, some social media thing. And I thought, I've always been interested in the John Turner, Colin Ward, architecture without architects kind of approach to things. It's where my heart lies, really. So I was immediately inspired, and it's got a fantastic picture on the front cover of New Babylon, hasn't it, by Constant Noy.
Usually known as Constance.
I was actually referring to this in the lecture I gave yesterday, and I spent about 5 minutes trying to say his name in various ways. But Constant Noy Venhuis, isn't it? It's something along those lines.
It could be, yes. I don't actually know how you would pronounce the Dutch. I usually just call him Constant. So,
but this book you've got, which is an anthology, an encyclopedia of examples of what you are interpreting to be anarchist practice in architecture, or something along those lines. And it's beautifully illustrated, really beautifully published, and with a really great introduction, which is where I've drawn some of our my kind of questions mainly from. But I thought maybe we could start by by you kind of outlining your motivations for this specific book. Where did the inspiration come? How did you get to this point where you're looking 20 odd years ago at Victorian sewerage systems to the role of, to the potential of architecture as, and its relationship to anarchy?
Okay, I mean, I have to sort of work backwards in, and start with like how the book came about, really, because it was a very unusual and quite specific reason why I did this work. And that was because I was asked to do it by an individual and the company he represents in London. So the company is Shiva Limited. And I think it was in 2018, he approached me. The company approached me to ask if I would like to do a research project on anarchism in relation to architecture and produce a book. So the whole process was essentially kind of a funded project, but funded in a very unusual way in terms of like academic life. This kind of thing doesn't never happens, right? You have to go through the right channels. And this was all the wrong, you know, it's like a sort of very, but for me, it was like, one of the questions, whether to go with it, whether to embrace it as a process. And, you know, after quite a long time thinking about it, I decided to do that because I thought I would learn an awful lot from the process. But I was also interested at that point in a kind of architecture, which is generally not considered to be architecture. And it's not really architect without architects. It's more architecture without architects. It's more stuff in the city, which is sort of almost always in between buildings. And the reason I say that is because I just finished a project, a much more academic project on, a couple of years before I started this, on ruins and ruination, which had been my preoccupation in the years up to 2017, I finished that project. That was really my first independent research project, which was much more political in the way that I was writing, political and personal in the way I was writing. So that project involved visits to sites of ruination from Chernobyl to Detroit. Also in Manchester as well, I did like a mini local project in my home city. Also went to Sicily and also went to Varosha in Cyprus. And those trips were really amazing for me to be able to do, but they were also extremely challenging, sometimes quite dangerous as well. Varosha particularly is a sealed off town in Cyprus, which is extremely difficult to access. But that sort of project, which resulted in a book, an academic book in 2017, I think is sort of bridge between these two projects, that it gave me a bit of sort of sense of courage to embrace things that felt a bit uncomfortable and a bit different and a bit sort of not within the academic kind of conventions of either how you do research and how research is funded. So for me, it was me being able to sort of go with it, I think, had a history beforehand as well. So it wasn't that I was specifically interested in anarchism as a political kind of theme or a project or an idea or movement, but that came to be the focus of a broader interest in, it's not architecture without architects, but it's architecture without the hierarchy of architectural production, which I think is a little bit different from what you might call vernacular buildings, which is celebrated by someone like Brodowski, or even low tech, which is a more recent kind of celebration of indigenous building. And that's why the focus was mostly on the global north. Because I think once you start to move into this question of, well, then, you know, self-building is the norm, really, in the so-called developing world, right?
Yeah.
Called the Global South now, although it's there's lots of slippages between those two domains, which I think are quite interesting in their own right. And I found that it was really important to try and, you know, if I was going to use anarchism, it had to be sort of not so loose that it could be anything, but also not so tight that it was restricted to, you know, a purist anarchist vision, which does exist, which is held to by certain kind of places within anarchist kind of thinking.
Maybe you could, like, what would that purist description be? I mean, what are the roots of...
Well, if we look at the roots, I think that's a good place to think about that. So, you know, anarchism as a movement, and, you know, it begins in the 19th century, really with a dispute between two men, so, between Marx and Mikhail Bakunin in the 1860s. And that split became decisive in 1872 at the Workers' International, where, if you like, anarchism becomes a kind of sect of Marxism, I think. That's how I describe it as an origin. So fundamentally, it is a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
It's a socialist politics. The key difference for Bakunin, anyway, was the role of the state in any future socialist society.
Mm-hmm.
And for Bakunin, he rejected any role of the state, whereas Marx saw the need for, I think it's like temporary state, or, you know, the state was still important for Marx, and therefore hierarchy was still important for Marx. Bakunin completely rejected that. And I think it's something that probably to do with their personalities as much as their politics, but it produced anarchism as a strand of, I would call it, libertarian socialism. So I think that's actually a more precise way of describing anarchism, due to the fact that anarchism has all these negative associations. Mm-hmm. Libertarian socialism, I think, is a better, more precise description of what really started anarchism, you know, in right. terms of why it's different to socialism, mm-hmm. in terms of it's actually not that much different.
Yeah.
But it's different in certain key areas. Most particularly the role of the kind of governance in a socialist society.
So what inspired, I mean, so both Marx and Bakunin are looking obviously at the conditions in the 19th century of the working classes, particularly the working urban working classes. Would you say that anarchism was born out of an idealism that the people, broadly speaking, had within them, and collectively and individually, the capacity to make a better world? Or was it born more of a negative thing, which is that what was going on was unsupportable and therefore anything would be better? Is it, you know, do you know what I mean? Was he looking at the conditions and saying, oh, well, people could do this better themselves? Or was he looking at the conditions and saying, well, this is appalling, we just need to step away?
I mean, I think, you know, I'm not a historian of anarchism.
Mm-hmm.
And there are historians of anarchism. So someone like Ruth Kinner would be, you know, she's a brilliant, her book on anarchism is a brilliant and embracing all the complexity of, not all of it, but as much as can be put in a book of 300 or 400 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So I should say that, really. But, you know, from my perspective, it is probably both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly rejection of the kind of society that was being produced by industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is a heavily centralized and urbanized
mm-hmm.
society, which was being challenged, really, as... for, you know, for any number of reasons, as being seen as a very negative development in human history. So I think it's always on the basis of, yes, we are fighting against something, but it certainly isn't the case, say, anything is it's not a desperation.
No.
No, it does have a concrete kind of notion of, well, how do you do that? Then becomes the focus of anarchist kind of writings.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, I think, and this is often not really known, particularly by architects, that it's within early town planning and early geography that we see that almost the most important influence of anarchism in kind of development of serious thinking about how these how the world works. Yeah. So figures like Peter Kropotkin, Elise Reclus, and also unlikely people like Ebenezer Howard, mm-hmm. and Patrick Geddes, which are they're more important to in the British tradition, and someone like Colin Ward,
mm-hmm.
is probably the most important British writer, anarchist writer on space, place, and architecture. Mm-hmm. He continuously refers back to Geddes and Howard, and before that, William Morris as well.
Mm.
And I think that aspect has been really neglected in mm-hmm. particularly in academic studies, where Marx and Marxism continues to be the main focus.
Mm. So this idea of anarchism with its roots in a kind of I like this idea of it being socialist libertarianism for a start. I think that's quite an interesting way of framing it. But these movements like William Morris's movement, and here in Margate, I think Pugin, in East Kent, we have Pugin, who has overlaps with that kind of thing. They're looking back to a time pre-industrialized British society, where there was greater reciprocity between workers and masters, I suppose, and a kind of that reciprocity allowed for greater freedom of personal identity and expression, and therefore the production of diverse cultures. And industrialization is seen as being an erasure of those things, or it produces. I've got a wonderful book by Ruskin, where he talks about essentially the erasure of identity through industrial manufacturing processes of architecture, which I think is really, really amazing. How does, I suppose, to update it? So you've talked through, and you've got to Colin Ward, and Colin Ward, as you say, is really important. How does this then carry through into the later part of the 20th century into the contemporary sphere? How does this anarchism, which seems somewhat defeated now, the rise of neoliberal capitalism has been almost universally embraced? Maybe that's controversial, but I think it is true.
No, I think you're perfectly right to say that. And it's for sure. But that you could say the same about socialism as well, I guess. We're not talking about, we're talking about all alternatives, effectively, mm-hmm. That seem as equally impossible as each other at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually, strangely enough, I don't see as potentially quite positive.
Mm-hmm.
The dominance of the socialist alternative and the fading of that, I find quite promising in terms of that there can be more equality in terms of what is being proposed.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a kind of hegemony of socialism, I think, which has been kind of problematic in broadening the alternatives, particularly, I think, when it comes to thinking about green politics.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a moving away from a monolithic understanding of what, there's only one type of socialism, there's only one kind of neoliberal capitalism.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what I think what Ward has done and why. So Ward's the centenary of Ward's birth is coming up next year, and actually there are going to be quite a few events. Bristol Festival of Ideas are doing a series of events. I think what the interesting thing about Ward's thinking is that it's predicated on a slightly different understanding of what constitutes anarchist politics. Mm-hmm. It's more what would be called now a prefigurative or emergent politics, which is really about describing things that people do and then saying, you know, they exhibit kind of anarchist tendencies, mm-hmm. but in a way that people don't quite know that they're doing that. Mm-hmm. This is a sort of unconscious idea of how politics might work. Mm-hmm. And Ward would point to people like allotment owners, people who are squatting through necessity, or even things like children's playgrounds, where he would see certain kind of tendencies within things that he observed there as being indicative of kind of something else or something else that could be nurtured and grow, which how he sees a kind of notion of how change, radical change, could happen, mm-hmm. which is very, very different from overthrow and takeover, which mm-hmm. is a classic idea of revolution. And certainly within socialist history, mm-hmm. that's been the mainstay in terms of how you think about radical change. And for me, that's been quite important for things like ideas about the commons, ideas about protest, ideas about kind of DIY urbanism and activism in the city. All can be read, I think, if you agree with Ward's analysis of what constitutes anarchist politics, in a similar way. And that really was my approach in this book. Mm-hmm. That I really did. I responded very strongly towards writing in that respect. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting to kind of go back to that and slightly rethink it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I felt was like, well, then you could pretty much say anything was anarchism, right? Mm-hmm. If it's all unconscious and prefigurative and vague and emerging, then it sort of slightly lets you off the hook of being rigorous. And do you know what I mean?
In terms of how you're
describing the world. Mm-hmm. And it also could be very presumptuous in terms of, you know, saying the allotment owners, the allotment holes are anarchists, when they would probably object to that.
Yes. Yeah, that is
a certain arrogance that you could say mm-hmm. is a problem with that idea.
Yeah.
The other problem is a question of scale as well, and that it's valuing something very small in the world, if you like, something which is not, you can't measure the effect particularly, and it's operating at the level of the individual or small groups, mm-hmm. and that translating that, scaling it up, is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Very difficult to do, because it kind of operates on the basis that this will happen, and, you know, these kind of bigger scale things will happen organically, if you like. Mm-hmm.
So this comes to this question of its relevance. So I appreciate your description of Ward's idea, this emergent practice, anarchism as a sort of, well, anarchist urban practices as a kind of emergent quality of quite a lot of stuff. But I think when people think about anarchism, they think basically it's people running around smashing stuff up. They might think of Antifa, or they might think of, I don't know, the Black Hand Gang or whatever it is, some of the movements from the late 19th, early 20th century. Who are alleged, amongst other things, to have started the First World War and stuff like that, or precipitated the beginning of the First World War. But that's not what he's talking about, and that's not what anarchy is, and this kind of libertarian socialism is not trying to do this. It's trying to produce an alternative space for the human flourishing by disestablishing hierarchy, power hierarchies, which cause people to live in suboptimal environments which don't enable their self-actualization. So you can see the relationship to Geddes, you can see the nation relationship to Ebenezer Howard, where the Garden City movement start providing spaces, and even in the Homes Fit for Heroes post-war stuff, providing spaces. And my own father was raised in one of these in North London, where you get really generous housing for working class people, which enable them to do all sorts of creative things, gives them freedom for the first time in their lives in real terms. So this idea of an emergent practice, but as you say, it's complicated because, you know, what are the boundaries of this? Like, where do we stop? Is you know, the action of a giant corporation doing sort of insurrectionist capitalist practices, is that anarchy, or is that just chaos, or is that something different entirely? And I guess you're left with that problem, that idea that you go far enough around any political circle, you end up at the opposite of what you started at. So anarchism becomes, libertarian socialism becomes somehow connected to libertarianism in a capitalist sense, but it's nothing to do with that, is it?
Well, it's not nothing to do with that, because the libertarian aspect of it is, you know, one, but everybody has a different notion of what makes them free, right? So, and in the US particularly, there's a very different kind of tradition of libertarian thinking, which doesn't make such a clear distinction between socialists and capitalists of liberty. And many anarchist historians will not include that. You know, there's a sense in which we can't include that. It goes against the fundamental kind of socialist origins of anarchism. I would be a little bit more ambivalent, because partly because of the nature of, you know, the commissioning of this book and the research was done by a property investor in London. You know, he told me that he's the only anarchist property investor in London, but nevertheless, if there's one, there's more. There's potentially to be more, and it really challenged my attitude about wealth, however it's acquired. And it is actually really, you know, one aspect of change is really important to try and get over leftist prejudices of wealth and the value of wealth and what can be done with it. It really interested me, that dynamic, and where I was sitting there, and it became an interesting way in which we talked about the project as well, which I found really interesting.
So this is Shiva Limited, who run the Anti Pavilion on Regent's Canal.
Yeah, and actually through the time that I worked on this project, particularly towards the end, was the most kind of intense time in the life of that project. So they had they've always had battles with Hackney Council, but in the 2020 competition, where the sharks were put in the canal, it kind of blew up into a kind of a full scale kind of onslaught by the council, who issued a kind of a stop notice, which meant they couldn't install all of the sharks. And then in the following year, when I was finishing the book, they exhibited these towers built by Extinction Rebellion protesters, and there was a big police raid in response to these towers just simply being there. Rather than kind of any sort of intelligent interpretation of them as actually they're not there as acts of protest, they're there as art installations, which I also found like it really complicated the issue significantly right at the end of the book. So actually me being engaged with the life of this particular organization and what it was doing was also very provocative for me. Because it's sort of, the terrain on which academics tend to operate, or writers, is not that terrain. know, it's we're stuck in quite small insular worlds.
Mm.
Which I'm not saying is a problem for me. You know, that's what I like as a writer. But being exposed to this sort of quite attritional, you know, relationship between planners and someone trying to do what I would regard as very interesting work, it really opened my eyes to the kind of dynamic going on when it isn't all this very pleasant. You know, it's tough. It's really tough. Even for someone with resources, right? It's tough.
Yeah. The Anti-Pavilion is really interesting. I mean, I would like you to talk about some of the examples in the book. The Anti-Pavilion is really interesting because it is, as you say, it's, you know, funded by a developer, and it is trying to do this thing, this emergent practice of challenging the logic, the dominant logic, hegemonic logic of the urban realm. And London is, you know, increasingly dominated by what seems from the outside, certainly I don't live in London, I haven't lived in London many years, but seems from the outside to be like a juggernaut that's just taking over the whole city. There's less and less distinctions between, or possibilities even of distinctions as you know, prices spike and so on and so forth. So I really like this idea. I, in fact, strangely enough, a few years ago, I actually put in a proposal for the Anti-Pavilion whilst I was working in practice in Glasgow. Yeah, which was quite good fun, and I gave a talk at one of his events as well in London. Which is too rude to mention, but anyway, it was good fun. So I really like this idea of the Anti-Pavilion contesting this. And there was a question that I put to you before we spoke, which is, what is the relevance perhaps of anarchist architectural practice, in your view, to contemporary urban life? Like, what does it do? What does this emergent, this not generalized emergent practice, this Wardian idea, shall we say, but in the intentional action of intervening in urban space in this anarchist, with this anarchist objective?
Yeah. So I think it's the fundamental thing for me is it's the provocative nature of it. And it provokes a certain kind of sense of this, wow, this is possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it opens up a possibility which wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes certain people or certain groups, you know, with a lot of courage and perhaps also resources to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
The risk's quite high, and they get higher each day. And this was an interesting development in the course of the changes in the law, the way in which the Home Office were really tightening up on acts of protest happened during the course of the writing of this book. So, I went to the Extinction Rebellion protests in April 2019 and wrote about them in the book. And I found that to be a really amazing example of suddenly other possibilities were suggested. And they were not radical things. They were, can roads be places where people walk and do other stuff on? And I really think that had an effect on some of the things that happened during COVID, when people spontaneously chose to close their roads, have the children playing out, and that still continues just around the corner of a road. The residents close it off once a month and they all meet outside. Those kinds of actions don't happen out of the blue. And I'm not saying there's a direct causation between Extinction Rebellion protests and what my neighbours are doing around the back. But that kind of, for me, that's the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I take that as a given, that kind of, inspiring others, even though it's quite vague, perhaps, is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
We really underestimate that, because it's really difficult to make those direct links when something like that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly does happen. And I think it's really important to bear that in mind. And that is something I've found really important in in, you know, when you're describing something, it's that sense of provocation, inspiration, mm-hmm. is really, really important. It doesn't have to be anything big to do that. It can be something very small.
I mean, it's quite interesting this. So if to go back, if Morris and Howard and so on are writing in relation to industrialized urbanism, we're now in a very different context. We're a post-industrial society. It'll be hard pressed to find a smoking factory anywhere. But there is still this discontent, and it's something that I think about quite a lot. Which seems to be that modernity itself, as a paradigm, has produced a lot of discontent. It seems to dislocate us from Mother Earth. It seems to make us feel not at home. And these little movements that you're talking about, these little anarchist practices, reflect on, as I read it, on these historical precedents where there is a desire to reestablish the rights of people to the places that they live. And this Lefebvrean idea, Henri Lefebvre's idea about the right to the city that David Harvey has articulated so beautifully and so profoundly as well. And I wondered whether you might want to talk about whether these practices, whether these emergent and these anarchist practices are, like, what role do they play, as you know, in this bigger urban debate about how we access the commons, as you put it, how we access the commons of our urban lives. And I apologize now for the extremely convoluted way I ask questions.
No, I was born this way.
I can't help it.
I mean, I do think there are two ways of looking at that question, and you know, for me, there's a really fundamental question that I keep coming back to, and that's the notion of, well, how much and what kind of how do you see the way you work as an individual, right, mm-hmm. or in a group of people? How do you see that as, you know, is our idea of agency and the effect we have mm-hmm. fundamentally kind of problematic in terms of how we've been told to think about these things? Mm-hmm. I think there's a particularly capitalist idea of agency that it's interesting that anarchist writers I've come across do draw attention to this, like Simon Springer, who's a geographer, really, really interesting academic writer on anarchism, but draws attention to this notion that we tend to think of scale in the way that we're presented it, right? Mm-hmm. That somehow, you know, a citywide sewerage system has to be citywide. And it's, you know, it's interesting to come back to sewage here.
Yeah.
Because when the system was built, that wasn't the case at all. There was a large kind of resistance to it on kind of the grounds that we want to be responsible for our own sewage, mm-hmm. rather than taking it away from us and creating a centralized network that effectively removes any responsibility from our
who led that kind of resistance?
Well, it was disparate and not very effective, right? Because obviously it's cast as being backward and mm-hmm. you know, non-progressive. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to be really careful of how we evaluate these points, I think, when other kinds of opinions are expressed, that we don't evaluate them in by the very criteria that are defining, you know, defines the world that we live in. Now, of course, we can't help but do that. But I think, for me, there's something really interesting about just kind of trying to prize open that notion of how we judge the effect we have mm-hmm. on the world. Because I do think there's lots of different ways we can think about that. And for me, like, the Wardian way is almost, it's almost a kind of pushing into the background this desire to influence things and to be effective, and which we're always told, right, our impact, mm-hmm. you know, we have to measure it. And I would say there's a strong case for really resisting that and being open to perhaps a lighter kind of sense for your own agency, which is not to dismiss it or to be, to say we don't have any agency or to be resigned, but just to wear it a bit more lightly and actually to say, well, I don't have a lot of control over it, in fact. And therefore, I think this question of this question always comes up, like, how can very small projects like an eco village or an intervention in the city like Anti-Pavilion change these structures, these structures which are bearing down on us and causing all of our problems? Mm-hmm. That is the same question that comes up with climate change as well. That we are asked as individuals to bear the weight, if you like, of the structures that need to change, right?
Yeah.
And it causes a what I would call like a bit of a schizophrenia of our own feelings. Is like, where do we exert agency? On the one hand, we think recycling will somehow make a contribution. On the other hand, we think there is, you know, it's so tiny, it's totally insignificant.
Mm.
And I think there's room there to play with that, the idea. And I think that's a really important way of lightening the hold that the dominant ideologies have on us. Some groups do, it's really interesting, like groups like the Situationists have a really interest, you know, the sort of sense in which subversion can be a much lighter thing, a much more fun thing, being told to recycle. And that really interests me. And I think anarchism opens up that a bit.
Yeah.
That more overly serious minded politics don't, or they shut down, particularly green ones, I think.
That's a really interesting idea, actually. I mean, the idea of playfulness is something, actually, funnily enough, I wanted to sort of ask about, because your book is broken into, what is it, eight sections?
Yeah.
Eight sections: liberty, escape, necessity, protest, ecology, art, speculation, and participation. And it was section seven, speculation, that made me think about this playfulness, which does this idea that anarchism is also a device, or anarchist practice in architecture is also a device for hope. It's not just, as you say, something to do with challenging status quos and hegemonic power and so on and so forth. And a lot of what XR did and a lot of Occupy movement did were fundamentally, although very serious in their intent, as you say, very, very tiny actions that were characterized by creative, imaginative, and you use that word at the beginning, imagination, which is something I'm fixated on at the moment, and joyful ideas. And, you know, in your section on speculation, you pick out Libius Woods, one of the greatest draftsman ever, I think, and you know, hit with his sort of quasi sci-fi architecture. So I was just wondering about this idea again of the anarchism as a kind of mechanism for joy, in a way, for delight, and perhaps a challenge to what is seen as the contemporary urban's lack of delight. It's a lack of beauty, you know. And to go right back to the beginning, where you're talking about sewerage systems, the Victorians made delightful sewerage systems.
Yeah, I mean, and I think reading an act of anarchy, like smiling at someone on the tube, or you know, something as banal as, or offering someone flowers, or you know, if you read those things in a serious way, they become very interesting. You know, it's not that you're being serious, you're being frivolous and for a serious reason. But if you see those things as political, they suddenly become a sort of doorway into another way of kind of relating to the world, which is much lighter, I think, lighter touch. I'm trying to, you know, this is something I'm trying to do with my students, because you'll know that architect students come now with this weight on their shoulders of the ecological, catastrophe, climate change. They're coming with it as a burden. And although, you know, it heartens me that they care so much, there's something about it which I find that aspect I find difficult, that I love to see them wearing it more lightly, because they're individual people, they're not but there is an expectation still within architecture schools that you're doing something much bigger than yourself, right? You are you're there to propose something really impressive and that when an act change or and I think there's no harm in just stepping back a little bit back from that, and absolutely with not the intention of denigrating someone's work or their, you know, their beliefs or anything like that, but actually to just make it more fun.
I mean, one does wonder whether it's possible when one is so angry or anxious to be creative. And I think Doris Lessing talked about this, that you know, genuine creativity does require to a certain extent a sort of ambivalence, perhaps.
Ambivalence, yeah. But it was really, you know, interesting that working with Shiva on this, I saw both of those things. I saw extraordinary anger expressed towards the officialdom, if you like, but also great joy and great kind of release and excitement.
Yeah.
And I think there's a sense in which we, you know, anarchism is like sort of throwing yourself in, kind of seeing what happens. It's like it's a very immersive type of, and it's quite disorientating in a way if you're used to more systematized ways of thinking about politics. But you know, from a personal point of view, that is what I respond to. I'm very anti-political in the sense of organized politics, in the same way that I am in relation to religion, for example. And that's probably a reflection of a good number of things in my life. But it's what primarily attracts me to anarchism is that sense of that it's just opening up the very notion of what politics is in a way which I find very exciting and very liberating.
Yeah. So this idea, and you've mentioned the word scale a lot, and I'm always interested in scalability and the idea of scale. So it's an emergent and it's a marginal practice, anarchist design. And in almost all of the examples in your book, from Plotlands to Gordon Matter Clark to the Calais jungle, we're actually talking about tiny things in relation to massive things. And this light touch, I think, is a really beautiful way of putting it. It's very speculative. Does it have scalability outside these kind of speculative projects of Constant and Libius and so on? Does it, or is its role always as an agent provocateur in relation to hegemonic power structures? Is that what it's supposed to be doing? And through that affects change at the kind of structural level in incremental and minor ways? Or does that, in a way, I suppose, does that mean that architecture fundamentally can't be anarchist in the kind of classical political sense of it? But can only kind of ever be, as I say, agent provocateur, grit in the oyster, so to speak.
It is, you know, it's a very good question. And the only answer I can give is that I really do not know.
Darn!
but on that question does rest, you know, a lot of the objections to, I mean, David Harvey's, that's his principal objection to anarchism, is its lack of scalability, and that you have to have hierarchy to organize on a big scale. And I don't know, because the problem is we don't really have examples of anarchism working on a big scale. And that's not necessarily because it doesn't work on a big scale or it can't work on a big scale, but because it's been sort of crushed. So there's a sense, there's a bit of a sort of, there is an unanswered question there, because of the nature of it's not ever. I don't know if you've read Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed.
No.
Which is really, it's a science fiction novel, but it's really the most concrete attempt to talk about anarchism, an entirely anarchist society.
Yeah.
And it by no means utopian. I don't think it is utopian. I think it has a really interesting ambivalence about it, about what that would mean for people in terms of what they have to give up and what they have to embrace as well. You know, I think in talking about emergent politics, in a way, the question of scale resolves itself. I would be of the structures in place are so destructive at the moment that in a way, it's kind of imperative that, you know, we either just get on with it, we either just get on with the small scale, which is kind of generally how we all live anyway, right? Mm-hmm. It's a reflection of the reality of our lives that we operate on small scale. And that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. Or we destroy the structures. There's a sort of, for me, there's such is the strength of the structures. You know, I was just walking in the City of London a couple of days ago and the same, it's same in Manchester, not quite the same level of power being expressed there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, architecturally, those buildings are, you know, they're like aliens. They're like alien spacecraft that have landed in the last 10 years. They've all been built in the last 10 years. I mean, it's absolutely incredible, the speed. And what do we do with that? You know, what would we do if aliens invaded and established an oppressive regime which was going to destroy the planet? Mm-hmm. What would you do? You'd mount a grassroots resistance campaign.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I see it. You know, I do see it.
I fully agree. I mean, it is quite funny, isn't it? Since 2008, when obviously the markets were corrected and they all felt, you know, mea culpa, and then they've been building buildings like they're as rich as Croesus, and pretending that they're not doing the same thing again. And lo and behold, the same thing's about to happen again, which is the bubble.
It's the same thing on some kind of steroids, which.
Yeah, amazing. It's like we caught them out, and so they're like, "F you, we're going to do it harder."
So in a way, you know, to me, the question of scale is like a sort of I see it as a distraction, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And it's partly because I am quite pessimistic, given the scale of the other side, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm sort of pessimistic only when I start to get bogged down in that question of, you know, how can things change?
But you use the example, and weirdly enough, and I hadn't noticed this before, and I've been using this in teaching for a few years, the issue of Tahrir Square, the taking down of an extraordinarily violent and an extraordinarily oppressive regime simply by standing and gathering.
Yeah.
And this idea I use, Hannah Arendt's, I talk around it, around Hannah Arendt's space of appearance, the idea that power emerges when people gather together and disappears the moment they disperse. And that's kind of what anarchist architecture is doing. It's creating spaces of appearance in which, because I've been thinking about this a bit recently, that there is a kind of charade quality to the system that we live in, which is that we allow it to pretend that it's not doing any harm. Yeah. And in return for that, we don't get our heads kicked in.
Exactly.
You know, we don't get chased from. We don't get our houses foreclosed. We don't get our, you know, whatever it is, our water poisoned, et cetera, et cetera. We don't get oil slicks. But actually, it doesn't take much to disestablish hegemonic power.
No, indeed. And I think we. Yes, we've kind of been duped, but we're part of the duping, right? We're complicit in it.
I think we enjoy it. It's like going to the theatre. It's like you suspend your disbelief. You're like, there's a man climbing up a giant beanstalk at the panto season. That'll do. I'll have it.
And yeah.
I think we enjoy the theatre of letting them think they have. No, I don't know. Maybe I'm being facetious, but.
Well, I know, and I do, no, I absolutely see that, and part of that was you know, walking through the city. I enjoy the play of the light on these these alien spacecraft, and they're you know, that I'm pummeled into this kind of submission, you know, there's something enjoyable. There is that's, oh, someone's, you know, maybe it's like this idea of someone's in control, right? Someone's, and therefore things are going to be all right. So yes, it's complex. And, you know, but you're right about, you know, but some would say in Egypt, nothing has changed. It's gone back to the same as it was. Maybe it's slightly less brutal, but it's nothing has fundamentally changed. But certainly the people who participated in that will have fundamentally changed. And maybe that's the point. Maybe the point is personal transformation is more important in the end. And personal transformation can you know, that's quite, that can happen, right?
And so rather than looking at the scalability is something to do with having the agency to shift the structural inequalities that make the alien spaceships possible, plausible, acceptable. Whereas the anarchist libertarian, the socialist libertarian idea is that you do a thing, it transforms yourself, and then you act better in the world.
Exactly. And it is more modest, I think, in that respect. But I also think it's more realist. It's more realistic, actually, in that respect. I think, you know, we're almost always, all the time, encouraged to be unrealistic about our importance, our, you know, which isn't profoundly unhelpful, really, because it doesn't get us anywhere. It doesn't really sort of, you know, so I think I find, you know, I do find that realism in anarchism, slightly paradoxically, that it's really grounded in actually really a strong pragmatism. Even though it is fundamentally very optimistic about what humans can do if they were allowed to do it. So it's not, it doesn't have a sort of dystopian tendency, or like Ballard, you know. I love Ballard, but Ballard is...
Not the jolliest guy.
But his power is ambivalent. He doesn't allow you to sit, you know, you're sitting on the fence all the time about, you know, and it, I have to remember that, because I think that's quite important as well to bring to the table. But ambivalence can be a cool ambivalence, I think, is not what's required, and much more committed, painful ambivalence. And then Ballard is good, you know, he suffered for doing that, right? he didn't enjoy what he was doing.
But I think it's a really interesting point, and it's, again, something I've thought about over the last few years, is that it's the removal of the middle ground as an acceptable place within political discourse, and even within architectural discourse. It's not enough just to be good at doing architecture. You have to adopt this world change. You've got to be a world changer. Your research has to be world leading. And rather than saying, well, I'm okay, and being at peace with that, and trying to see both sides of every story, trying to, does the anarchist thing get there? Is that part of its?
I really do. I really do think that is, and it's so grounded in pragmatic action, which is probably one of the reasons it doesn't get very big, right? Yeah. Because to get big, you have to sort of pretend that other people aren't quite the same as you. And as you move up the power system, as you move up the hierarchy, you become more as an individual and others become less. That's just the nature of hierarchy.
Yeah.
So abolishing hierarchy inevitably, I think, creates a lessening for the majority of people. It's like redistribution of power for an anarchist means that nobody really has any power, or at least not for a very long time.
Yeah.
It shifts around. And that's one of the interesting things about the dispossessed, is that, you know, you get to do all different jobs, but you never progress in a career.
Yeah. Oh, that would be nice, actually. The tyranny of a career. I did want to, so this idea of the small scaleness also relates obviously to its mode of production, which is through collaborative thinking and shared and a sharing, which obviously then doesn't relate very well to big or social organizations, because they become unwieldy, and then someone says, well, I'll be the chief because I'm the best at this, and you get this kind of, whereas the anarcho-syndicalist or socialist libertarian is more distributed, and that, as you say, that necessarily lends itself to a smallness, and I think also that also means it's quite delightful as well. I was wondering, to finish, maybe you could tell us about what was your favorite project you came across? What was your favorite example within this book, without obviously offending anybody?
Well, the one that I keep coming back to now, because I'm doing work now more specifically on ecology and architecture, is an eco-village I visited in 2019 called Lammas in Western Wales, where I think it's about, it could be 15 people are building their own houses and essentially living off the land. I think it was, I stayed there for a weekend and only really talked to one couple there who were founder members. It was founded in 2009. But what I found, I kept coming, and when I was there, I found it like, there was a lot of sort of spiritual talk and stuff about, you know, being at one with the universe, and that I felt was grating against me a bit.
Well, you come from Stockport. You're about as urban as it gets, mate.
Yeah. And also, you know, it was pretty, I wouldn't say white middle class, but it had a sense of like, you know, it wasn't really representative as a community of cultural diversity that you would find in the city, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, what I keep coming back to is the sense in which every single aspect of their lives, they are thinking about and adapting and changing. And for me, there was something very beautiful in that application to architecture and also infrastructure. So one of the guys there I talked to was talking about infrastructure somehow like his second skin, because he'd been involved in building it. And I thought that's the kind of thing that is a basic kind of anarchist idea of space and place, is that you are intimately, almost like joined with your environment, the built environment and the non-built environment, if you like, in a way where you have this intimate relationship with it, which is, again, you have a high degree of responsibility, but also, you know, the payoff is really, really high, I think. And also the allowance of animals and things to come into buildings, I found really interesting. Another kind of anarchism, if you like, a disorder of other beings, which has seemed very deliberate, actually, in the buildings there, and made me quite uncomfortable at times. But it felt to me very unusual and very sort of considered, though, very designed in a way. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just stayed with me as a place of inspiration that I go back to, even though it's very small, very privileged in some respects. You know, you do have to have capital to be part of this community. It's not the kind of capital that you need to buy a house these days, but it's not insignificant. And you have to have resources in other right ways as well, right? You know, the kind of resources you need to live off the land and build your own house, which I don't have. I don't have the skills or the competency or even the will, really, to do that. So I appreciate that. But it's interesting that if you see something happening, even if it's small, it can have really big effect on you. And that's, to me, is a very hopeful position to really sort of end on, that, you know, it, and you may not know it at the time either. It may be, and generally that's the way life works, right? Isn't it? Something has an effect on you. You don't suddenly change things. The structures change, you know, they gradually change. It's like, because that's the way change happens. It's meaningful change.
That's a lovely point to end on. Thank you very much, Paul. It was lovely to talk to you.
Thanks, Ambrose. It was fantastic.
Well, wasn't that wonderful? Thank you to Paul for entertaining my ignorance with elegance and humour. Thanks to his publishers, Paul Humberton, for the book. There's a link to it in the podcast description, and you should probably buy it. Please like, subscribe, follow and share, if you will, and thanks for listening. Cheers.